Hi everyone, my name is Adam Small.
And I'm Jake Moses.
Welcome to our podcast, The Performer's Pathway.
A podcast adventure to help guide and navigate your musical life and career.
As a prelude to every episode, we'd like to remind our listeners that this podcast is about the other side of the musical coin. One side, which you see a lot at our website, mymusicmasterclass.com, is what to do in the practice room. And the other side is how to maximize your talent and skills in the real world, and that's what this podcast is about. Also, if you have a few extra seconds to spare,
which is technically only 3 beats at 60 BPM,
please subscribe to our show on your podcast app of choice and rate us 5 stars. You can leave a comment about absolutely anything, too. That small act of kindness will really help us expand our audience and continue to create new episodes.
And lastly, word of mouth is always super helpful. So if you like what you hear, please tell the world.
All right, everyone. So we are here in the virtual studio with me and Jake and a good friend, longtime friend and a great musician, Charles Ruggiero, who is in LA as well. And although Jake and Charles are in LA because of the current situation, they are not together. So yeah. Anyway, Charles, how are you doing, man?
I'm actually doing really good, to be honest with you. Like things other than the potential that I've got one gig that's on the books that hasn't been canceled yet.
No way.
And it's like a great, like, it's like just something I've really been looking forward to, and it hasn't been canceled yet. So I've still have my fingers crossed, but if that doesn't happen, I'll be bummed for sure. But basically, other than that, I'm pretty good, man. Things are all right. I've got my wife and we have internet and food and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, I'm still like, you know, making music on some level. Like I still get to go to my shed and play a little and, obviously, you know, that we're making music because we just did one.
True.
Yeah, that was
you
dope.
Know, it's yeah, that thing was cool. Right. So things are good, man. Really. I mean, just other than that, I hope that gig goes together. But
when is it on the books? You said,
was it like October or something?
No, no, way closer than that. I'm supposed to do the Village Vanguard with Kurt Rosenwinkel and Peter Bernstein and Alex Claffey June, like the second week of June. So it's like just a couple weeks away. It hasn't been canceled. So I think we're kind of holding out hope. But
right.
It doesn't look good, but you just don't know. I mean, they could just announce it like the day before. So, we'll see what happens. I got my fingers crossed. That would just be incredible.
Yeah, man.
That would be a fun week. You know what I mean?
Oh man, that sounds great. I don't even know if I've ever heard like Kurt and Pete play together. That actually is a really cool pairing when I think of it in my mind.
Is that even allowed? Like,
yeah, I mean,
for humanity.
They've done it before.
They've done it before.
When Kurt asked me to do it, you know, he told me who was on it, and I was like, oh man, that's going to be great. Or actually, it happened more like this. He asked me to do it, and I was like, do you have any tunes you want me to learn of, like, meaning of his, like, what do you want to do?
Right.
And he sent me back a list and it was all standard, just all right. Standard shit. And I was like, well, I know all this. He's like, yeah, well, whenever I do it with Pete, we usually just like play tunes. And I was like, oh, okay. I get it. Like, I see it's not his original music. He just wants to kind of blow with, you know, mm-hmm. someone we're all sort of in awe of Pete Bernstein, you know.
Yeah, so. He's the man.
Yeah, that's he's awesome. The best.
And he's one of the nicest guys you can meet and humble.
Yeah, he really is.
You know, this is a question a lot of people ask, and you've lived this. So you're a New Yorker. You were born in Rochester. I know that mm-hmm. for a fact. And you were in New York City for many, many years where we met. Mm-hmm. And you went to Manhattan School of Music before me, but still, you know, we share a lot of the same friends. We've known each other for a while, like I said. You know, people say that the West Coast and the East Coast, you know, have these differences. And, you know, sometimes it's magnified. People say, you know, everything on the West Coast is this and everything on the East Coast is this. And obviously, that's not true. It's not that cut and dry.
Yeah.
But what do you find in terms of jazz? Because I know you do more than just jazz. I mean, you've done a lot of gigs, and we can get into that. But in terms of the jazz scene, I'm curious of what you think, you know, the main differences is, or the similarities, you know, for people that are maybe thinking about moving either to New York or Los Angeles?
Like, that's a sort of an age old question, right?
Yeah.
Like, what, you know, like, people always compare, you know, this and that. And right, in this case, we're talking like New York and LA. And I think that the disparity used to be far more legitimate than it is today. I think the world is smaller because of technology. It's not a situation where, like, you know, Charlie Parker is happening in New York City and it takes 6 months or a year for people to get to, like, in LA to hear about it. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you hear about anything overnight if it's really, if it's serious, if it's that important. Because of that, like, the disparity between the two places has gotten much smaller. For me, and I've gone back and forth a bunch of times. Like, I lived here, then I lived there, then I lived here, then I lived there. Like, I've gone back and forth and spent time. I'm sort of here now permanently in LA. I can't imagine really living back in New York at this point, but
you don't want to do any more snow, I think.
No, I really don't, man. No. I really don't.
Like, especially because you were born in Rochester.
Yeah, actually, I'll tell you what, it has more to do with physically playing the drums than anything. Like, if I played trumpet, I would fucking live in New York City because I can put a cup mute in and play in my apartment, and I, like, can just put my horn on my back and go to work. Whereas playing drums, it's like maybe 50% of the places have drums. So you're talking about, like, bringing your drums down the stairs in the cab, in the thing, with the snow. I mean, that shit is no fun at all.
And when you're younger, it's like bringing it on the subway.
Dude, you know what I mean? Like, my before entire drum set on the subway, like, every day for a long time.
With, man, like, an 18-inch kick or like a 16 or something like that.
Totally, man, totally.
Yeah.
Plus, there's like no chance of you practicing at your apartment in New York.
No, you can't.
No. I mean, there were some of those pre-war buildings. Yeah. I mean, some of those pre-war buildings actually had pretty thick walls.
For sure.
So you could kind of get away with it, but like, you just, there's no room. It's not about sound. Yeah, it's about, like, there's not enough space for my bed and the drums. You know what I mean? It's too much. But so back to the question, right? The for me, the differences that exist today are really primarily more about, like, proximity. See, in New York, you can go, like, look, if you go to the West Village, right? Just as a for instance, you can go to the West Village and be, you can walk from the Village Vanguard to Smalls to Mesro to Fat Cat to the 55 Bar, right? And each one of those places is having at least 5 hours of music a night, at least.
Yeah.
In most cases, more. Like, outside of the Vanguard, you're talking about like two and three different bands per night, you know? And so you can spend, and every one of those bands is going to be like really high level, like super high level.
Yeah.
So you can kind of be in New York and be, and even still, like, you can get in a cab and go up to Smoke, or you can go, you know what I mean? Mm. You can go somewhere in Brooklyn or, you know, the whatever, you know, one of those places out there and see, you know, there's lots of different spaces. In LA, it's more like you can do one thing a night. Like, you do, you either, you go see this person or you go see that person. There is no, I'm going to go to see this set for here and that set there. So the community aspect is different. Like, there's not as much hanging and there's not as much, like, of a sort of scene socially. It's more kind of work-based.
Right.
And I think that adds to the, that, I don't know if it's a byproduct of or just an addition to or whatever, like, but I do think it is connected that New York has always been more of a sort of the like, music is about art there, and here music is about business. It's like the not business as much as like entertainment. Like, LA has more of an entertainment aspect to it, whereas New York has more of an artistic thing to it. Now, that being said, I do think that in and of itself is changing because New York is becoming like, because what's happening in New York is what's happening in New York, and what's happening in LA is happening in LA. Yeah. I see that that is also shifting. Like reds, like, you know, like they talk about like Texas becoming a blue state. Like, I sort of feel like LA is becoming a little bit more, there's a little bit more artistic integrity than there right. used to be. You know, I do feel that, you know, and there's so many cats that are moving out here. Like, it's bananas. Like, you could put together, it used to be like 5 years ago, I could put together like, I don't know, maybe like 8 really, really strong rhythm sections.
Right.
Now I could put together 20 without and without even thinking about it. Just like killing musicians out here, like beboppers, like cats who really play jazz, not just like guys who can kind of play it, you know, but like really legitimate players. It's wild.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be just like Goldings and Mincer and Russ Ferrante and Bob Shepard and, like, you know, the cats that have been there for a while.
Right.
I mean, you know, and the legends, of course, and some cats are moving, but most of the New Yorkers weren't there. And I tell people the same thing about the community. It's funny. My thing is I say that the subway, in a weird way, although, like, I do not miss a subway at all because I took it for so many years. Like, you run into people. Like, when I was living uptown, you know, I just would run into Bernstein, like, on the subway, like, taking his cat to the vet, you know, and I, you know.
Right.
We would just, or whatever, you know, you run into whoever's up there. Spike was up there. Like, everyone that's up there, you just kind of see, you know?
Yeah.
And,
New York is a small town.
Yeah. In LA, you have to make a point to see someone, you know, you know,
right. If you accidentally see someone in LA, it's actually kind of dangerous. I remember seeing, I was driving on Highland and I look over to a cafe I used to always go to, and I see Joe Ayoub's afro.
Oh yeah.
And I like just busted a U-turn, like, exactly. Just and went over there and parked and jumped in and said, "What's up?" But I was like, "Damn, that's a lot of work."
I love that dude. I miss that guy.
Yeah,
I feel the same way as you, and I've seen the migration because I was out there, shit, like for 7 years. But
yeah, right.
I'm trying to think of, like, and so I've been back here for 4 at least. So let's say like 11 years ago, or, you know, I moved down. And it was different. Yeah. I mean, there was very little jazz. There were some great jazz musicians, but not as many clubs. It's a different scene now, which is totally cool. Plus, the weather is beautiful. So, I mean, there's a lot of things to consider. I always tell people that, and you told me when I was thinking of moving there, because you were there already. Uh-huh. And then you moved back to New York, and then you moved back to LA again.
Right.
But you said, you know, it's 74 degrees every day, and you know, and
I remember when you called me and said, "Hey man, I'm thinking about this," and I remember specifically saying, because I did the same thing. I ran into Greg Hutchinson, right. and I knew he had lived out here, and I remember very distinctly. I was like, "Man, I'm thinking about moving to LA," because I was playing in like this rock band, and we were out here all the time, and I just, you know, I wasn't playing a lot of jazz in New York City, so I felt disconnected to the scene. And I remember him saying, he goes, "Let me tell you about LA." He goes, "People say that it's full of assholes." And he goes, "But you know what? Everywhere is full of assholes. At least the weather's nice there." And I was like, sold.
That's what I tell people all the time.
And that's what I remember saying that to you, Adam. I was like, "Let me tell you what Hutch told me." And then like 2 months later, you were here. So they're like, it really works.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in my mind, it was always dependent on what you're looking to do too. Like, if you're really looking to do more pop gigs fresh off the press, LA definitely has a lot of that. And I would say more than New York, even though New York has its pop gigs, that LA has just more auditions. You know, I did so many auditions out there if you want to do that thing. But now, like, you know, there's a lot of, like you said, you know, a lot of artistic stuff going on. And, I mean, and there's things to consider, right? Like, your rent in New York is going to be super pricey, although, you know, we are in the middle of an apocalypse, so who knows if that shit's going to drop. But yeah, your rent in New York's going to be super pricey, and of course it'll be less on paper when you get to LA, but it evens out because you get a car and you get car insurance, and that's stuff you probably wouldn't have in New York, although some people have cars. You know, so it does kind of It's not more expensive than New York, that's for sure. And it's probably less. Well,
this is what I have found is right. It is about the same financially, mm-hmm. but I make more money here.
Really?
Like I just, I just earn more money and earn more money more consistently here. Right. Like I had to have a second job when I could not live in New York and just make music. Like right. It was not attainable for me. I had to have a secondary income, like a source of income mm-hmm. here. It's like there's just more work and there's more like high quality. Like, and that's the other thing is in New York, I was a jazz musician. And right. so even though I was in a rock band, I was kind of on the rock scene, so to speak, there, it was like, I was in one band and that was the one thing I did. And then like, as a freelance musician, I worked in the jazz world. New York has a way of sort of pigeonholing you in a sense where like you can be in one thing and do that one thing. Whereas out here, there's a little bit less stigma attached to like, oh, you're this kind of guy or you're that kind of guy. Like being well-rounded is not a four-letter word in LA.
Right.
You know, and so there's that. That's a different thing too. Like, and I think the younger scene, maybe in New York, like the young cats in New York, like Curtis Noah Sad and Jonathan Barber, and some of those, mm-hmm. some of the young drummers that are coming up, and the other young musicians, mm-hmm. I find are a little more. They're more open to other kind of music than, say, the cats that were there when I got to New York. Like it was like you either play fucking jazz or you can right. fuck off. Like it wasn't.
Right.
It wasn't really. Welcoming,
yeah. You know? Even when I was, you know, saying,
"Oh,
thing.
I'm yeah, yeah."
Most cats, when I was doing it, you know, it was pretty much like you made a choice to play one or the other, and
right.
You even made a choice to play electric or upright. Actually, I mean, mm-hmm. some guys doubled, but not as much, you know.
Yeah, if you doubled in a lot, at least on the jazz scene, as I remember it in the early '90s. Like with Dwayne Burno and Peter Bernstein mm-hmm. and Josh Redman and that, like, yeah. you know what I mean? That class of people that I was mm-hmm. kind of a part of that scene. Like, yeah, if you played upright.
Yeah.
It, like if you played upright, you didn't play electric. Like
yeah.
Christian McBride was the only person that did both, like that owned an electric bass, but did gigs on upright and was considered to be elite on upright. But he mm-hmm. did play some e-bass like with Josh. Like I remember him having an electric bass on some of those tours, you know what I
right.
mean? And nobody was like, oh, well, McBride sucks because he plays electric. Like nobody said that. But unless other than McBride, I can't think of anyone that was like really taken seriously if they also played electric bass, which seems ludicrous to me and especially now, but at the time that was sort of the mentality.
Yeah.
You know, Avishai Cohen was another guy who kind of got away. Like he could play electric bass and no one was giving him too much shit about it. He was another one.
Let's talk about kind of your beginnings. Cause I know that your father, Vinny, who is a great drummer, you know, he taught you early on and,
no,
I know, oh, he didn't.
No. I never, I was, my father, my mom and dad got divorced or like, you know, they separated whatever when I was like maybe three or something. Mm-hmm. And then my father died when I was eight.
Okay.
So I didn't really pick up a pair of drumsticks like other than my father sticking them in my hands. Like
right.
I didn't pick up a pair of drumsticks on my own until I was maybe a 12.
Okay.
So I started playing around then, but I did study. All right. So this is how it kind of went. Because my dad was a big deal where I'm from, everybody mm-hmm. assumed I was going to play drums. So like in right. school, like the school band teacher knew my dad and was like, right. well, obviously Charles is going to play drums. Like, right. you know, so they tried to
no
get
choice,
me to play
kid.
Drums. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I mean, being like any normal child that is fatherless, like, well, even whether you have a father or not, like I think most kids want to be like their dad or their mom, right? Mm-hmm. So like, I want to be like my dad, I'll play drums. But then they'd say, okay, play on this pad. And I'd be like, well, I don't want to do that. I want to play drums. I don't want to play on a pad. Fuck you, you know?
I know. They always
so I would start and then just give up immediately. So eventually what happened was when I was about 11 or 12, I was, you know, just like hanging out at the like local t-shirt shop, you know, like iron on t-shirt world place. You
know? Totally.
Were you like a skater kid?
No. This was in like maybe 1982 or something.
Right.
So I was in Rochester, New York. I was like,
old ass motherfucker.
Yeah, no shit, man. I'm going to be 50 next year.
I'm scared of Rochester, man.
It's gnarly there, man. There are parts of that town that are fucking crazy.
Yeah.
But we grew up like in a pretty poor neighborhood, you know what I mean? And so just think of like your typical 70s, like stoner type situation. Like it was like black Puerto Rican and white trash stoner types in my, you know, the little t-shirt shop had all the cute girls that worked there. So we would just hang out there, you know? And one day this dude walked in and was like him and his wife. And he was like, "Hey, do you guys have any jazz t-shirts?" and I was 11 years old. So the word jazz and my dad were like together, like in my mind, they were fused. So he said jazz t-shirts. I was like, "Hey, did you know my dad?" and he's like, "Well, who's your dad?" And I said, "Vinny Ruggiero." And he's like, "Holy shit, that was my drum teacher." So it turns out that this dude was like one of my dad's like elite students. And so at that point I went home and I said, "Hey mom, I met Steve Curry." You know, he told me his name and we talked for a minute. He goes, "Oh, I remember you when you were yay high," you know? And I was like, "Mom, I just met Steve Curry. I really want to take drum lessons with him." She remembered Steve and loved him. So she was like, "Fuck yeah." So she like, you know, we didn't have a lot of money at all. So she like put that like whatever $40 a week or whatever it was took towards that and like made sure that I got drum lessons. And so I studied with one of his students and all we did was study shit that my dad showed Steve. So in a sense, I kind of like got hand-me-down lessons, like, you know what I mean? From my dad in a sense. So, and you know, and then growing up, like, of course I would go to see him play gigs and he was playing with all the cats that my father had played with when he was alive.
Right.
Like
it was a scene.
Yeah. So all those guys, all these old Italian, you know, jazz musicians in Rochester were like telling me stories about my dad and talking about tits and like, you know, like I was like a young kid and they just were like basically like showing me the ropes in a sense, like in the best / worst kind of way, you know?
Right.
And I just would like go and sit in. So I kind of got to know my dad like osmosis, like in terms of, you know, like just through osmosis, through hanging around with people that he was tight.
Right.
You know,
let's move on a little later past the point where you were at Manhattan School of Music and the Chuck Mangione gig. Was that a strange coincidence that your father had played with him, or was that kind of understood when you also got the gig? Because you did an audition for that, I think, right?
Yeah, the way that went down was that, you know, Justin DiCiocio, who was my teacher at MSM.
Yeah, super cool guy.
Yeah, incredible jazz educator and just a human being. Like, so Chuck had kind of put himself behind the eight ball for a bunch of years and he didn't work for a bunch of years, maybe 5 years or something. And he was kind of wanted to make a comeback. And so he called Justin, who was like, you know, basically the head of Manhattan School of Music at the time, or was beginning that his tenure in a bigger role. Chuck knew Justin. So he was like, "Hey man, you know who all the hot young cats are. Why don't you, you know, put a band together for me?" And Justin was like, "Well, you got to hear Vinny's kid. And Mangione was like, "There's no fucking way I'm ever hiring. Cause him and my dad didn't really get on."
Right.
Like he would fire my father every night and then hire him back every day. Like he'd fire him at the end of the gig. And then the next day at like 2 p.m, he'd call and be like, "All right, the gig's at 7, you know?" And so he told Justin, he was like, "I'll never fucking hire him. There's no way in hell." And so Justin didn't. And I found out because everyone I knew was auditioning for Chuck Mangione's band. And And I called Justin and was like, man, how come you're not setting me up? You're like, what the fuck? What am I, chopped liver? Like, I should have an inside track on this gig. And he was like, he goes, he doesn't want to hear you. Like, he doesn't want anything to do with Ruggiero's ever again. So I guess he ran out of dudes. He just didn't really dig anybody that he heard. And I heard that he listened to 70 drummers. I can't imagine that's possible. Like that. I just don't think that seems like an exaggeration to me, but yeah. He probably heard a like bunch 30 of
30 or and something.
Maybe, you know what I mean? And he just was like, you know, he finally called Justin and he said, okay, I'll give him a listen, you know? And then I went in and we played and I thought we were going to be like playing Feel So Good and all hits, you know? We got together and he's like, let's play Autumn Leaves. And I was like, well, okay, I can do that. You know, like I can play jazz, you know, that's fine. And we played because it's funny too, because at the time I was playing like pretty regularly with like Ryan Kaiser, Mark Turner, Chris Potter, Brad Meldow, Peter Bernstein, like people that went on to be like the stars of the jazz world. But at the time they were just like my boys, like,
was like 22.
Yeah, exactly. Like 21. So it didn't seem, it just was like, I've recently actually thought like, man, what, how different would my life have been had I not taken that gig? You know, and I couldn't imagine not taking it because at the time it paid like a grip of money. Like I was making real money playing jazz. Like, right. So I was, you know, and I remember too, because Chuck asked me, he's like, call whoever you want to come do this audition with you. Like, I just basically want to do a jam session and play tunes with you and your friends. And I called Pete Bernstein. I was like, hey, Pete, you know, I'm going to go, like, you want to do a session, you know? And he's like, well, with who? And I was like, well, it's really for Chuck Mangione. Like he wants to hear me and some of my friends. And he's like looking for a band. And Pete was like, I don't want to do that. and I remember thinking like, what? Like, what do you mean? But like Pete was already like playing with like legitimate heavy cats. Like he was, you know, he was working with like real, like he had already working with like Lee Konitz and like, you know, Jimmy Cobb and shit. So he didn't care, you know, I still thought it really mattered, you know, and of course it did, but you know, so we went ahead and I did that session and it was Bob Snyder played, you know, I used to play a lot with his brother who played, John Snyder, the trumpet player.
Yeah, of course.
We played a lot together. And so his little brother, Bob, was on that session. I forget how it all ended up going down, but I'd ended up not knowing anybody on the date. It was just like four guys kind of thrown together. And yeah, we just played Autumn Leaves and blues and whatever, couple other tunes, Stella by Starlight or whatever, Olio. And he was like, oh, okay, you sound like, you know, of course he's like, you sound just like your dad, you know, like, you know, he just like, I got, he's crying. He's like, I can't believe, like, you know, and all of a sudden, like, everything was like brotherhood, you know, brotherly love all of a sudden, you know what I mean? Which was weird to me. And he's like, call your mother. I want to talk to her. Cause they knew each other back then, you know, and, you know, and then it just, we took off from there, you know, and Chuck was, I don't mind saying it now, but he was just so awful to me. Like I'm grateful. And I was really happy to do that work.
Right.
You know, but
and you got that really cool video of you and Gad together.
Oh yeah. I mean, that shit was like life changing.
Yeah.
But Chuck was really mean to me, like in front of 5,000 people on the microphone, he would say like the most god awful shit. Like just like in the microphone on stage, 5,000 people, he'd be like, I would have sent you back to the fucking rock I found you under, you motherfucker. Stop playing red shit. You know, I was like,
it's like whiplash.
Oh my God. He was, it was so terrible, man. He was so abusive, man. He was so abusive.
Jesus.
But you know, whatever. Like it was also a great time too. You know, I mean, I saw different parts of the world and I got paid really well and I found out what it was like to really travel. Like, yeah, I got my road chops together. Mm-hmm. You know, I learned a lot, you know what I mean? And you know, yeah, that I got to hang with Gad for like 2 months, like yeah, double so
you,
drums.
You definitely know? Met a lot of people that you still have relationships with from that, right?
100%. Yeah, 100%.
You know, after that start, right, you're working in New York. You know, this is something that I think maybe could be useful for, probably can be useful for a lot of musicians. Mm-hmm. But you're sober now, which is something you're candid about.
Yep.
And you've been sober for how many years now, man?
12 and a half.
Holy shit.
Damn.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I knew you on both ends of this. So, I mean, like, this is something yeah, where it. I saw it all, man. And, you know, how did this affect your work? And if so, how did you have to repair that reputation afterwards? Or, you know, and how do you feel health-wise? You know, just go for it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I am candid about my recovery. And I think it's, you know, it is the best thing that ever happened to me because, and I can really say that honestly, because without it, my life wouldn't be good today.
Right.
You know, my life before I got sober had great moments, but wasn't inherently any good. And my life today is inherently good, even when I have bad moments or bad things or whatever. Like, and so for, like, in terms of the work, right? Because this is a podcast for musicians. And so mm-hmm. I want to try to keep it to the work aspect of it.
Right.
And this, I mean, look, this is just my experience. And this is what I have discovered to be the truth. I don't know how much work I lost from being an alcoholic and a drug addict. Because the world of music is full of alcoholics and drug addicts, and people don't like to think about their own drinking and drug abuse.
No, so you're right about that.
A lot of cats want to be around like party and the nightlife. It's like, mm-hmm. then you don't really have to look at your own shit.
Right.
So.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely part of a lot of hangs.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. For sure. And like, you know, look, man, it can be nerve-wracking to get on stage in front of 250, 5,000, 10,000 people. Right. Like, that shit can be nerve-wracking.
Or even like, just like 50 musicians in the audience looking at you, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So having a couple drinks or a little smoke, a little weed can really, the idea of taking the edge off is like a legitimate idea. That's not some bullshit. Like, that's serious.
No, it's what Charlie Parker did and all those guys did too.
Everybody did that shit. You know, people are just like, man, I'm about to go up and do this thing, this record date or this TV performance. Jocko, like, I'm going to be on Saturday Night Live, like whatever. Like it does help, like kind of, you know, it kind of like puts a little bit of, it gets you loose, you know,
takes it's lubricant.
Yeah, but that's not how I got down. I drank and used very heavily, and I kind of always showed up for work. Like, I don't know if it ever interfered with, or how badly, if it ever really truly interfered with my playing, but my personal life was really a mess, and I know that I made some enemies. You know what I mean? I didn't get fired because I didn't show up or because that stuff, but I know I made some people like that mother, like people are like, you were crazy. Like right. you were like a cyclone coming through the club. You know right. what I mean? And like, I didn't really want to deal with that. So I'm sure that I didn't work as much as I could have or lost gigs or whatever based on my just like Tasmanian devil sort of self. But I always did work too. You know what I mean? I always mm-hmm. like, I was kind of fun to, I was also kind of like, the Tasmanian devil can be kind of fun. You know what I mean? Depending on who, you know, like cats that we know, like no one right. ever really was like, oh, Charles is a drag to have around.
No.
You know what I mean?
No, you were always invited.
You know, but, and on the other hand, like I do feel like I probably have lost work because I don't drink anymore. I'm sure that people are like, I don't know if I want him around because he's a teetotaler. And look,
I don't want to be judged. Right.
Yeah. And I'll just say out loud that like, I don't and have never and would never, ever, ever judge anybody else's drinking or using. It's not my place to do that.
Yeah, and I can attest to that.
I don't care.
Yeah, like, no, I can attest to that because we still have plenty of friends that drink very much. Yeah, they go bananas, and you don't say a word.
Not a fucking word, because it's because the thing is too. It's like it's not. I don't know what their inside life is like, and I don't know. I just don't know. Yeah. And yeah, some of our friends or people that I know, like I for sure, have some issues. Like, but it's not.
But they have to come. They have to figure it out.
It's not
that they
my
want
business.
Help.
Yeah. They could. They couldn't have told me, so I can't tell them.
Yeah. Right.
But that being said, like that's just a personal plug for my like just so that all the listeners know, like I would never do that. But I'm sure people like that's probably what they think. It's like, oh shit, man. It's like me being sober around people who are wanting to get really loaded and it's making them feel a kind of way. Like that's not really on me. That's on them. Yeah. And so, you know, and it's just like, I wish they knew how little I cared about their drinking.
Well, you even worked in bars after you were sober.
100%. Yeah. I mean, I still work in bars like as a musician, not as a bartender anymore.
But no, but
like,
I mean, you did.
I'm around booze all the time. My wife drinks. She smokes weed. Like,
yeah. No,
you
know it's there's impossible not to be around booze. I mean,
it's, it's just you can't do it. And so,
it's legal. Yeah.
You know, I'm always, it's like this thing, right? I don't care about how much you drink or party or whatever. I don't, unless you ask me and if you ask for my help, which a lot of musicians have, like I've had a number of different cats come to me and be like, hey, I think I'm drinking too much. Mm-hmm. What do you think? You know? And my first question is always like, you know, my first question is always, well, have you tried to stop?
Right.
You know, and certain people are like, no, I never have. I'm almost like, well, then why don't you try stopping first before you like throw in the towel and quit forever? Just like try laying off. I could not do that. Like I could not. And there's something to be said for like if you're drinking like and you it's like I don't it's like that thing, right? Like I could stop anytime I want. I just don't want to stop. It's like I had that. But then there came a point where I wanted to stop and couldn't. It's like not stopping when you don't want to stop. Like who can say?
Right.
But like there came a point where I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. I like really don't want to do this. And I couldn't put it down. I just kept reaching for it against my own will.
Right.
And that was when I really sought help, you know? Mm-hmm. And yeah, but there's enough men. It's like there's enough people out there that are – on both, it's just like anything else, man. There's people on both sides of the coin. Mm-hmm. There's good people. There's people who are never drink or party and are total twats. And then there's people who drink all the time and are wonderful people. Most of our friends, even the ones that party really hard, and we have some friends who party serious.
Some of them are just cockroaches. They're resilient.
They're just great people.
Yeah,
and they're beautiful. They're just beautiful people that like know how to work hard and they know, and they never, you know, they don't cause any trouble. They're not trying to fuck your old lady. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, yeah. No, you know? That's exactly.
It's just they party.
It's part of their thing. Yeah. You know?
And I know people that are sober 20 years that are the biggest pieces of dog shit in the world. So, like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't, everything has got to be judged on its own merit. You know what I mean?
Right.
You can't lump anything. It's like, you can't lump anything together with the others that are like it. Otherwise, you know, racism and, you know, xenophobia and all that shit would make sense. And it doesn't because it's like you always know someone who breaks the mold.
No, you know but in your case, it's like you know that there was some maybe enemies or maybe just some work that you lost during it. I know it happened to some other friends. I won't, you know, say their names, but, you know, another good friend of ours also quit drinking. He knew that he had lost work from it and he, you know, repaired that by, it just took people a little time to realize he didn't drink anymore. And again, it wasn't as if he ever played the wrong notes. It's just that people are like, oh, he's wild. And whatever the case is, it doesn't have to be. Sometimes it's serious. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes a club owner won't want you around because maybe you say something to them and that's a big deal because they'll say, I don't want that guy in my club. And, you know, it's whatever it is, it's important just to look at yourself and figure it out, I guess, right? I mean, see where you are. And
yeah. And I mean, and that's the thing is, like, for some people, you have to, like, hit a bottom.
Right.
You know what I mean? And other people are like, whoa, this shit is getting weird. I should cool it. Mm-hmm. Like, and it's like the thing I say, like, you know, I have a couple of students, you know, I don't teach a lot, but I teach, you know, I do teach. And I had one kid who was taking lessons with me, and he was really good young player. And he was like, he got in trouble for smoking weed. And I just said to him, I said, look, man, if you want to, he was like, man, I don't know, man. I just love weed, man. I just love it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, if you want to be able to continue smoking weed for the rest of your life, don't smoke weed every day. You know,
right.
I was like, cool out so that you get to enjoy it. Because if you, this is one of those things that if you become abusive with it, it's that relationship is going to end. It's just like, if you, you know, it's like anything you abuse, you lose. Yeah. And that's just,
and then you can never drink again.
Yeah. If you really love it, treat it with respect. It's like any other fucking thing in the world. If you really care about it, then treat it with some kindness and treat it with respect, and it will stay, because drugs are not inherently bad. Right. They're really not. The drugs are great. Now, I don't think it's great for people to always be doing drugs, but, like, drugs feel good when you do them.
Of course.
Like, you know, that's smoking kind of the weed point. If it didn't feel good, people wouldn't do it. So I don't like have a bad feeling about drugs. I just feel like I was born and built and raised in a way that I needed it to be able to just function, just to even feel good about anything. Right. Like, I just had a really different, like, I just, someone said this the other day to me. He was like, we were talking about it. He said, I feel like I just got the wrong OS. You know, like, I just have the weird operating system, and it just was filled with, like, this command instead of me, you know, like, you know, 20 go to 10. It was like, I thought it was go to 10, but it was really go to 30, you know? And I just was always ending up, I thought I was making it right, but I always was going left. I have downloaded a new operating system that is more congruent with the way that the world actually works instead of the way that I think or was told it should work.
Right.
And life is easy now, or easier.
It's mainly about addiction. I mean, it's not even about the substance, because it could be, you could be a sex addict, and that could totally destroy your life, or a chronic masturbator, whatever it is, man.
Mm-hmm. CM.
Yeah. CMA, old baby.
CM, dude. I'll get you.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I know people in those recovery programs, and, like, every different element, it's like, you can really get addicted to anything. And it's not about the substance, like you said. It's just not. Because, look, I'm addicted to alcohol and drugs, right? Like, once I start those things, I cannot stop on my own. I can go to Vegas. Yeah. Me and my wife went to Vegas for a honeymoon, like, for fun for a couple of days before we went, like, somewhere else.
Right.
And, dude, I played roulette for, like, a couple hours. I was up, I was down. It was like,
right.
And I just, like, at a certain point, I just was like, I'm tired, I'm going to go upstairs. And I just cashed out and went away.
It's not your vice, right? But but some people are just, like, pawning their wedding rings there, you know?
Right. But and those same dudes can have one beer and not even worry about it. So you can't – it's like, if we both have the same addiction and the recovery – like, the recovery aspect works the same, right? Meaning like, if the cure works, you have the disease, right? So if we take the same cure and recover, but we don't have the same, like, sort of symptom, right? Yours is gambling, mine is alcohol, for instance, you know? It just sort of proves that it's not the substance. It's, and this is just my own personal, like, little whatever trip that I think is that I have a feeling it's like, whatever that thing is that releases that whatever chemical in your brain, the first time that, like, you were made to feel okay,
Actually,
right. The first time you, the first time like you say thing. Like, because I, the one thing in recovery that I hear, like everybody's got a different story, right? Like this guy was rich, this guy was poor, this guy didn't like his mom, this guy loved his mom. Like every person has, there's a million trillion stories that are all different to some degree. But the one thing that I hear every single person in recovery say, every single person to a man is, I felt different. Like I felt like I didn't get the rule. Like everybody else seemed to know what was going on. And I was like, what the fuck is happening? I don't get it. Right. That's the one kind of common thing that everyone seems to feel. And that in whatever, whether it's an endorphin or a serotonin, whatever it is, it's like there comes a moment where you associate whatever that association is when you finally feel like, ah, I get it.
Right.
Now I feel like I'm part of the club. Like you're chasing that for the rest of, that's what you're chasing is right. That feeling of sort of normalcy.
I see what you're
or
saying.
Like, yeah, of just like, oh, I'm not so weird or I'm not so different or right. I am a part. I am like, we are all one, you know, like mm-hmm. that's, and maybe the first time you get that is like when you hit blackjack and maybe it's when the first time you have sex or the first time, you know, you feel like loved by someone or when you're, you know, there's that thing. And when that happens, boy, you're chasing that. Talk about chasing the dragon. Like that's the thing you're chasing.
Right. I see what you're saying.
That's crazy. You're talking about that. I was just watching a LSD documentary last night.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, shit.
Wow. On LSD.
Really
Jake?
Crazy.
Really?
No, but it's Carrie Fisher. Tell stories like everyone tells stories. Sting, it's
oh,
insane.
Wow.
Oh, that's cool.
It's the
man.
Craziest thing I've seen. And Carrie Fisher was like describing when she did LSD and she she told a story and she was like, it made me feel normal,
right?
And so they cut to a doctor, psychiatrist, and he's like, that makes sense because that was at like the height of her career with Star Wars and everything, mm-hmm. and she was so not in her own self. She was so disassociated with like her own inner self that by doing drugs, it actually connected her with her, yeah. like herself. So mm-hmm. she actually felt like Carrie Fisher, like a normal person. But yeah, that was, that's exactly what you were just saying.
Yeah.
It's like, I feel normal.
Like what I thought, just like what I realize now is it's like everything else that in my life from that time is what I thought my life would be like if I stopped drinking. I was so scared of what my life would look like. And I was so wrong.
Right.
Like I was, and it just turns out that like I was wrong about most things. And it's like, that's a scary thought, I guess. But looking in retrospect, it's just like, big deal. Like I was wrong about a bunch of shit. And who fucking cares? Because now I can see. It's like, it just seems like such a monster. And so like, if you are a listener and you're, you know, and you're sort of at that place, it's like what you're afraid of, like it's a boogeyman because the reality of one's life after you put down this thing that's got you in its grip and you're able to sever from that, it's the freedom and happiness is almost unexplainable. It's like you can't teach algebra to an 11-year-old or like a 5-year-old because they just don't have the capacity to get it. You know what I mean? It's like trying to say like, man, my life today, like, you know, the way that it looks, like, dig this, I don't have to cheat on my wife,
right?
Like, and that used to not be me. I used to have to cheat on every girl because any girl that would say, oh, Charles, you're so good at drums, blah, whatever. It was like kryptonite. Like I could not say no to that. Right. And now it's like, it's not the way that it is for me anymore. Like I'm free from like that kind of, you know, that kind of thing. Like developing some self-esteem and some ground, like Jake was talking about being grounded, like that has put me in a position where like some girl at some club does not have any agency over me anymore when she says I'm cute and wants to go home or go to the hotel or whatever. I'm just like, later, you know, like I love my wife and I'm gonna, cause I loved those girls that I cheated on. I did care about a few of them very much and I felt terrible, but I just could not help myself because those girls had or I thought they had my self-esteem in their pocket. And so I went looking for it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
So the level of freedom that I have now from, and like, I didn't know that that was connected to my drinking. Like I had no fucking idea. Mm-hmm. Zero. I was completely oblivious.
Yeah.
But
you know, had to take your life back.
Yeah. That's with anything habitual though. I mean, that's the thing. Like changing a bad habit to a good habit, people just don't do it because they're like, eh, it's hard. Say no. It's no.
It's
no,
work,
no,
man.
No. It's easier not to. And once you do it, you're like, holy shit, I can do anything.
Right.
Well, it's just, if I could do that, I could do anything. Like, studying it now is better than ever because we have one thing in common as a mass structure is we're addicted to technology. We're addicted to phones. So it's like if anyone's ever confused about what that's like,
it's true.
Take their phone away.
Yeah, right. Watch the panic.
And it'll
watch
be like, that's attack. Like a fraction of what addiction is, you know? Yep. So it is very relatable now.
Yeah. Like a GPS.
And think about your life. Like, I don't know if either of you guys have ever done this, but like, if you leave your phone, like, yes, I panic for the first like 10 minutes. Yeah. And then I feel like, kind of free from it. I'm just like, wait a minute, this is better than I don't even know if I want to pick that phone up again because, you know, because you forgot. Like, I remember what life was like before phones.
It's like,
you know what I mean?
It's like camping.
Yeah.
Basically camping.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
everything comes like every minute that you spend doing something is, and I found this with like vinyl. Like I don't have vinyl because I'm some fucking audiophile. I have it because I actually when I purposely have to choose an album instead of just randomly pushing a area of my screen. Like if I have to manually choose an album and then work to put it on the thing and listen to the other side of it. And I tune in on a deeper level to it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And it's the same thing. When my phone is gone, anything that I do is more, everything I do is more meaningful when my phone is elsewhere.
Yeah, I can get
because
with that.
Because it's not drawing me to it. It's not pulling me over, you know, it's not pulling me away, you know?
Yeah, which is why people...
What are they saying on Instagram about me?
Exactly, people need to shut that shit off when they're practicing. You know what I mean? Like, they can... there's no way you can get anything done. I mean, you're just scattered. You hear like a... bleep, you're like, what the fuck is that? Someone comment on my post? You know.
Yep.
But, yeah.
Is it Cindy? Did Cindy like it? Fuck Cindy, play some scales.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But, exactly.
So let's like just talk a little bit about what you're doing now. You know, you got in touch with me recently and you said, hey, you want to play on this tune? I'm gonna send you a drum track, we're gonna do this tune, and put a phone in front of yourself and video yourself, and we're gonna make this cool video. And you know, it sounds amazing, man. You know, I played it and just to you, and now there's all these cats on it. You got Jeff Babko, Jane Monheit, who we all know, Laura, right? Laura Mace.
Yeah, Laura Mace, yeah.
And Al Street and Ian Henderson Smith, you know, these are all the fellas, and John Snyder, right? And Norris, right? Alex Norris.
And Alex Norris.
That's
the whole band.
And,
that's everyone.
Yeah, and it sounded really cool. I mean, it's a really great time to be doing stuff like that because... for obvious reasons, because no one can be in the same room. But, you know, what is the reception you've been getting from these things? And it seems like you've been getting a lot of likes or whatnot or social media action and things like that. But it really does mix-wise sound cool. Visually, it's cool. You did good work on it. And
thanks, man.
What is your thoughts on how is this keeping you sane and during this quarantine or whatever?
It started with... So Yamaha, I'm a Yamaha endorser, right? I endorse Yamaha drums. Mm-hmm. And they came out with this thing a couple of years ago called the EAD-10, the Yamaha EAD-10. And it's basically, in short, it's like a pickup for the drums. Okay. It would be the equivalent of like putting a pickup in a F-hole of an acoustic guitar, right?
Right.
Also does house a trigger unit because you attach it where it attaches on the kit is on the bass drum. So because it's like a, you know, where it's like it's a stereo condenser mic, it's not really going to like really pick up any beefiness in your bass drum. So what they did was they like added a trigger so that when your bass drum triggers it, you can kind of dial in or out, depending on what you want, some bass drum, like different bass drum sounds. And of course, it, you can, any sound that is in the brain, it can add whatever, mm-hmm. like a tambourine to your bass drum or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. But mostly what you do is you take it and you just beef up your existing bass drum sound. And then you plug it into your phone, and the phone has an app. The app can, like, you know, record and video, and like you can loop stuff and you can slow stuff down. So if I wanted to learn, like I did, right, I wanted to really finally learn the Oakland stroke exactly, like note for note. So I loaded the song into the app, and then I took like two bars of it and I slowed it down, and then I videoed myself playing along to it. Once you do that, you can, in the app, you can mix, like you can push the drums up or down, and you can push the track up or down, and you can sort of make, you know, you, and the, and the reason Yamaha did this was basically to like corner the market on like social media stuff, right? So instead of buying 4 or 5 or 10 microphones, mm-hmm. and an interface and Logic or Pro Tools and Final Cut Pro and blah, blah, blah. Basically, I can use my iPhone and this Yamaha EAD thing and make videos of me playing along with tracks, or like not just playing solo drums, mm-hmm. or whatever. It's this incredible tool that does all this different shit, and it's really great. It's like one of the best new inventions for drums in many years. It's super cool.
Yeah, because, and it gets your snare and everything.
It gets everything in it. And it's like, and if you have any skill in terms of balance, like if you know how to balance a kit, like I can make it sound good because I know not to play the hi-hat too loud or the snare too loud or whatever. Like I've got good sense of
dynamic,
like how to
control.
Personally mix my mm-hmm. own drumming live. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So it's because it's just one mic basically, like in the center of the kit. So it's awesome. And so they asked me if I would do a demo at guitar, like the Guitar Center demo for their website. Like, would I come in and play and kind of showcase it? And then I demoed it at NAMM. And so I've been sort of closely associated with this thing. And right off the bat, I was just like, oh, so I can go. And so what I did was like, I went and I played along with Ricky Lee Jones, Chucky's in Love, right? Mm-hmm. I just like played along with it. And then so I had a video, and I took the track all the way down. So I was left with like a video of just me playing drums. And it sounds good. Like the actual audio quality is pretty high quality, especially for just one little microphone unit.
Right.
And I was like, okay, well, let me see. So I sent it to Tim LaFave. I said, hey, would you want to kind of do this with me? And not Tim. I actually sent it to this guitar player, Matt Hornbeck, who I work with out here. And Matt played guitar with it. And then I sent it to Tim, and he played bass on it, and it just started kind of building. And mm-hmm. then I got Goldings to play keyboards.
Cool.
And yeah. And so it worked out pretty nicely. And this was before the pandemic hit. And I just was like, oh, I'm going to start doing these, like this remote recording thing, because it's so easy. Like I don't have to have any gear. I just have to have the EAD in my iPhone, and I can basically make like I wouldn't record like a pro album with it, but I would certainly record for YouTube or some kind of demo situation.
Well, sounds
and
good.
Easily. And so I just started doing that, and it's, and it like, and then I just started like, I was like, well, I want to do this tune. Well, I've always wanted to do that tune. I've always wanted to do this. And because of the caliber of musicians that I know and I'm friends with, and like I do favors for, and it's like, ask you, right? Like having me come to you and say, hey, can I have 10 minutes of your time? Like how much time did you spend like contributing to that track in total, like learning the tune and sending it and all that?
Like 25 minutes. I mean, yeah. I had to learn it, and like I wrote, and then I, instead of writing it out, I just looked at the waveform and I put markers in.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and I just marked the sections, and then so I knew where it was going to be, and then I just did like three takes or two takes, and I gave you two of them, and I just got my bass to sound the way I wanted it to, because I figured it'd be easy for you. So, but I'm fast, because I'm a studio guy. I mean, I know, so, I mean, mixing wise, you know.
Right. So to ask somebody to like, hey man, do you got a free half hour to like do this really quick? Like ain't going to take much. People are basically like willing to do that in this day and age because the technology is so makes things so easy.
And most people have some basic setup, you know, I mean, even if it, whatever you don't even need much. A lot, an iPad can do it, you know, iPhones. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. And so
as long as you have an interface-ish thing.
Right. Which is what this which is what this EAD thing basically turns into.
Yeah, as opposed to getting like a drummers. Yeah, because otherwise you need a stereo pair overhead, a kick and a snare. Yep. Or just a stereo pair overhead and a kick, but still. You got to mix it.
Yeah. And this thing is just like, it's just ready to go. It's just like, you can create a stereo drum track in as long as it takes you to play the track.
It's dope.
Yeah, so that happened, and then what that has led to is, and you can look at it, if you look at, like, on my website, I have a page that's dedicated to these videos that I've made, and I've done some others where I've, like, my friend played, he made a video, he's a piano player, he's a great piano player, Jordan Siegel, and he knows this guy who plays didgeridoo, they did a version of Stevie Wonder Higher Ground, like on didgeridoo and piano only. And it was burning. And I was like, man, this shit is slamming. I'm going to put drums to this. So I took their video and like downloaded it, put it into the app and played along and like just mixed it and like threw it up. So I've been at this point now, like obviously you sent me like a pretty finished bass track. Mm-hmm. But now I'm asking people to not send me dry, like send, because now I'm starting to like get deeper into the mixing thing. Cause I've always been a part of like mixing sessions and stuff. Yeah. And I kind of know, and we've talked about this, like,
yeah, we've talked about off film or off recording.
Yeah, off camera a couple of weeks ago, because you know, I'm now starting to like take that end more seriously because I want the quality of these videos to be better. And it's like, now I just get to basically do project after project. And instead of doing, and not that I'm going to stop making records of my own, cause I have a bunch of records out under my own name, but like now it's just like fun. Mm-hmm. It's like today's thing is more about audio and visual together. And it's not about records anymore. It's more about singles. Like we're back to the land of like pre-LP where it's like singles are the thing, EPs and singles. So I don't need to have a whole record's worth of things to put together. I can just like, I love that song. Am I the Same Girl? Like I've always wanted to do it. I was like, well, let's just do it then. So it makes it easier for you to just do the first thing that comes to your mind. And I currently have three, I think, more projects in the in the works, and it just kind of, it's keeping me sane and busy. It's like giving me something to do, like, cause I can't go do gigs, what I mean?
But you can also get your mixing chops up like we talked about on the phone.
Right.
When we talked. It's like, you know, and as we talked, you know, mixing vocals is kind of one of the harder things to do as well. So that's kind of how you cut your teeth doing it. You have a lot of stuff in the fire and also you get to call different people and it's kind of fun just to collaborate with different musicians around the world. There's no limits to geography, you know, it's not like, I mean, even 10 years ago, you'd really have to be, I mean, maybe five or four or whatever. I don't even know. Mm-hmm. Time flies. Yeah. Right. But you'd have to be in New York to play with the New York guys. I mean, the digital recording thing, it did work. You know, there's always people with home studios. You know, I have friends that have been doing it for many years, you know, over 10 years, you know, you send them the drum, like a track and they do drums for it. But now it's just more mainstream. It just seems like everyone has a capability of doing something cool, you know?
Yeah.
You don't need much. You know, even the USB mics, some of them are great. You know, we did Ian Hendrickson Smith, and Ian's a good friend of Charles and I. And, you know, he had a USB Apogee mic and that he did the podcast with. But, you know, of course, he also has some ribbons and all that stuff at his place.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's got great gear. You know, a lot of people do.
Yeah. In fact, we're going to do one of the next things that I'm going to do is I have a band with Frank Basile, the great baritone saxophone player. You know, he transcribed all Slide Hampton's octet music from the 60s. And I thought to myself the other day, I was like, man, why aren't we doing Like, why aren't we doing that? You know, because I've been doing all these videos. I'm like, what? Like, let's just do most of the ones I've done have been kind of pop or R&B-ish kind of tunes. So I was like, maybe I should do some jazz ones. So I pulled up I pulled up some of the slide stuff. And I thought, what are some of the ones that are more like through composed, where it's not like all based on like people blowing? Because I think it's hard to play jazz remotely because so much is based on like, what are you playing right now? Okay, that's going to inform what I'm playing right now. So a couple of the Slide Hampton things are pretty through composed. Like, right. they're really like, it's mostly all written out.
Right.
So I was like, man, let's just do one of those. It'll be short. You know what I mean? Because it's through composed and no one's got to worry about like blowing. It's just like, play the thing. I'll play the drum part and send it along. So I called Frank, and Frank said, well, I don't have any gear. And he goes, but I can record it on my phone. And I said, you know what? Let's fucking try it. And he sent it to me about 2 hours ago, like about an hour before you guys, before this started. And it actually sounds pretty decently good. Like, it's far enough away that it sounds. So I figure I'm going to give it a shot and see. And I mean, again, it's for YouTube, right? It's not, this isn't like, we're not recording an album. We have an album recorded.
So recorded on his phone?
Yeah.
And it's not distorted literally in preamps.
No.
As long as it's far away enough.
If it's far away enough, you know, you could also do some stuff with it. You can use this. There's D-Verb plugins if you want to do that. I mean, it might not be necessary, but you can get rid of some of the ambience and also some.
Oh, is that what D-Verb is?
Yeah. For instance, like if you're doing a podcast and you want it to sound up close and you have someone's ambient, I can use a D-Verb. And I mean, you know, you don't want a Band-Aid if you don't have to, but
right, of course
it can not be effective, yeah, for sure. It takes the
I didn't even realize that. Yeah, I did not realize that D-Verb was de-reverbing something.
Totally. It's getting rid of room ambience that you don't want. For stuff like that, you might want to use
excellent.
If you have phone audio, typically what you want to do is run I don't know if you have a lot of this stuff, but you want to run a noise reduction program. And what you do is you sample the noise by itself, just like if there's any hiss or anything. So you sample that, and then it just gets rid of that one frequency. And then listen to it and make sure it's not like messing with the sound of the horn or whatever.
Sure.
If it's not, you get rid of just enough of it. And then if you bring it up with a compressor, all of a sudden you can get it really present. But you don't have that crazy hiss, that background noise of a phone mic. Lots of like, you know, tricks.
Yeah, cool. This is my life. No, that's exactly. But that's the thing is like, that's kind of like when you asked me, the first thing you asked me was, how am I doing? And the answer was like, pretty good, because I'm still like, even though I'm quote out of work, like I'm not earning really any money except for whatever mailbox money I'm making from my music masterclass like Loop Loft and, you know, some of those things like CD Baby, like I still get a little bit of money here and there, but I'm not really earning any money playing. But I'm not destitute. You know what I mean? And then on top of that, like I'm actually still creating. I'm still in the process of like, I'm still feeding the monster that is my, like, cause if I stop creating or playing, like then I really do lose my mind.
Yeah.
So
you're learning new skills, man.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is just helpful. Like even just discovering how much a mix, like someone sent me a bass tracing, and I put it, loaded everything in, and I played the bass and drums together, and it was like, man, this shit is not hooking up at all. Like, this sounds really bad. And then I adjusted the EQ, and it brought it into focus, and all of a sudden, like, it was hooked up. Like the bass and drums were together, not because I didn't like move the track to line it up. It lined up as the EQ went differently. And that was like mind blowing to me, that like the sound could have that much of an effect on the feel of the song.
I've had this conversation many times with people, and one of the things I go to is like, let's talk about the Meters or the Beatles, like either one, you know, different musics, but you know, this applies to both. If you were to take like a really sterile, like 16-bit ADAT recording, just like with where you can hear these frequencies you don't want to hear and it wasn't mixed properly, like that shit wouldn't groove. And I, you know, someone might slap me for saying that, you know what I mean?
Right.
But there's something to it, you know what I mean? It's not, and it's not like the Meters groove, the Beatles groove. I mean, like the you know, all that old stuff, you know, it all has a groove, but the sound, it melds it together. Like, you know, you don't hear the imperfections, and the imperfections are actually make it swing, you know, or they make it feel good, you know. But I do feel that you know, sound is just mega important. Like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You can be loose, and loose is cool, but if you have a really sterile recording and the EQ is fucked up, like, no, it just sounds like you're making mistakes.
Yeah, it like ruins the feeling, and it ruins the groove of a thing.
Yeah,
if it doesn't, if it's not, if it's like too bright, or if it's, you know what I mean? It's like I didn't have to move, because normally I'd be like, oh, this is, you know, whatever. Let's say it was me who was behind, right? Oh, I'm really like I'm playing too far behind the beat. Like I would literally move the track to the left. You know what I mean?
But
this, it was just like, oh, I can EQ that into grooving. Mm-hmm. Like it's not. You know, the wave, you know, the shit is lining up, but it sounds weird. So then, and that was a real mind opening experience for me. And that's, and that will translate on some level, whether I'm conscious of it or not, that's going to translate into my playing from here on out.
Yeah. And it's the same with, like, you know, guys like Philly Joe. If you had Philly Joe on those records with Miles, or with whoever, playing with a Dave Weckl sound, and Weckl's obviously a monster, you know what I mean? Like this but with that clean sound, it would just have a completely different feel. It's not the same, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And
it
wouldn't, or even still, if Paul Chambers was too loud on that record, like if the bass was louder than it's supposed to be, it's going to interrupt the groove of it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Balance,
it takes nothing away from any of the playing. Like they're playing their asses off and they're legends, you know, but anyway, you know, that's just like, that's a rabbit hole of stuff.
Yeah. A welcome one though. I'll tell you that. That's a welcome rabbit hole for me, man.
No, I'm telling you, I mean, that's also something Gabe, you know, the Daptone guys were very good at, the mix of that stuff with Sharon and with Sugarman 3 and all that, it like it's so warm and like just tapish or what, I don't even know what the word is, that you can it just feels greasy, you know what I mean? Like the sound feels greasy, you know. You can get away with a lot of cool push and pull on that with that grid, you know. It doesn't have to be lined up.
Yeah. You know. And I think in most cases it shouldn't be. Like I'm a real, like someone was talking about a drummer that I won't really name because he's amazing. And I don't want to sound like I'm dogging him out because he's a bad dude.
Right.
But they were talking about watching him in the studio and that he like, quote, buried the click. Like you couldn't. Like he's so perfect you couldn't even hear that the click was on because he was so on top of it that it just like it disappeared.
Yeah, there's guys.
And I thought, and I just thought like I would never want to ever do that. that is not something that I think of when I think of it of music feeling good. Mm-hmm. Is I don't think of it like. It's like it would be like having a comic book with no shading, just like all solid color. You know what I mean?
Right.
There's shading gives depth, right? And I think that pushing and pulling, even from beat, like quarter note to quarter note, is as long as the quarter note is relatively consistent, I think the space between those notes. This is what my whole next Mind Music Masterclass is about, actually.
All right, good. This is the promo.
Yeah, this is the promo for it. Like the space between, like, let's say quarter notes 1 and 2, like the space between that deserves some contour. It doesn't deserve to be a solid color between 1 and 2. Unless, of course, that's what you're purposeful goal is. But I think, I don't know that, like, that doesn't seem like most people's purposeful goal in terms of music. Music is supposed to be an expression of emotion, right? And I don't view emotions as singular in color. I think of them in it, like, as shapes and shades and contours.
Unless you're emulating a sequence on purpose or something.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. Yeah. Unless you're purposefully doing it.
You have to play to a track or something. Yeah.
Right. Or if, like, and I think hip hop and, like, hip hop music or, like, rap or whatever it's called now, trap music, is, I think, in that music was born out of sequence drumming. Yeah. So in order to emulate that, it is required to play that way. And I think
that's cool, like that.
Yes. And I think, like, you watch Questlove play and he's like, I'm like, holy shit, he sounds like a drum machine, but, like, he's doing that on purpose. Like, that's, I want to sound like a drum machine because I'm playing Lottie Dottie. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I'm supposed to sound like that.
It's like that girl on YouTube who sounds like she's auto-tuning her voice, but she doesn't have auto-tune on.
Yeah, totally.
So I mean, you can look at it the same way of, like, equal temperament, like tuning. Like, if you look at our tuning system, it's perfectly even every single chromatic note, right? But we do that so we can stack harmony. So there's a reason for that. But by keeping that all even, you lose perfect thirds. You lose the sound of, like, the sixth. So thirds and sixths don't sound pretty. You know what I mean? So it's just like you're going to lose something with perfection. But if it's either for a reason or not, like with hip hop drumming, like, you want that shit to sound like a drum machine.
Yeah. I mean, even, no, it's a style.
But I don't think music is meant other than hip hop, which because it was born out of samples and born out of drum machines, I don't think, like, that excluded. I don't think music is supposed to do that. I think a chorus is supposed to rush. It's supposed to be faster. Okay. Like, naturally, it should be a little bit faster. It should be.
It's just feel the right way. Yeah.
Yeah, it should feel, it should have a little bit of heightened, right? It's supposed to be heightened. The chorus has that element to it. And if it doesn't reflect in a fluctuation, then I don't know if you're, you know, but then again, I guess, I mean, I talked with Chris Coleman, who, you know, the incredible
he's a monster.
That he is. He's just such a monster. We were talking one time about, he was doing the New Kids on the Block or NSYNC, I forget. But it was one of those bands. He was talking about the MD, like, at the rehearsals for the band, he was like, I want it to sound exactly like the recording. Wow. Like they were, like, dialing the sounds exactly. They were supposed to learn every single fill, every single note. It was supposed to be like, you were not supposed to be able to discern it.
Well, why did, like, they hire Chris? Like,
we'll check it out. So that was level one. Was the first thing, is like, learn it, play it exact. And then he said, and Chris was like, I was kind of like, man, this is kind of lame, whatever. And he said, as soon as the band achieved that, then the MD was like, okay, now let's take it. Now let's make it ours. Like, let's do that. But now we put our own spin on it.
Okay, I get that.
Like, level up. And I thought that's
actually kind of Zen, like Mr. Miyagi.
Yeah,
totally.
You set your base. You know.
No, right. I feel that. That's actually kind of a good idea. Yeah.
Which I thought was, I was like, man, I did not expect to hear. I was like, man, that's next level shit. Like, and like anything, like, if it's purposeful, okay, but, like, to me, the purpose can't be, the purpose shouldn't be like, oh, well, because, like, that's what's, you know, that's what I heard is cool. You know what I mean?
Right.
I don't think that's really all right. You know what I mean? Because then that takes the personality out of it. But to, like, get it to the baseline of absolute, like, imperceptible perfection and then add your personality on top of that seems hip to me.
Yeah, it is dope.
And you can only do that with a certain level of cats too. That's the thing. Right. Like, if you give them free rein right off the bat,
I mean, that
you,
band is probably pretty
lose
sick.
Some control in a sense.
Yeah.
So it's like, if we keep it here first, then you guys can, like, access what you are known for.
Exactly.
On top of that.
Exactly.
Just, like, badass,
exactly.
You know?
But to be honest, like, that's very, very much like jazz school. You know, I mean, every accomplished musician would say, like, they learn the standards, they learn the vocals, and then they learn this, right, and they listen to like an old Sinatra recording because he doesn't stray too far from the melody, and you know, like some people like, and they've listened to 15 versions to, you know, and done all this work, and then they make it their own eventually. But
true. That's actually, that's a really astute point, is that that is basically the same thing. Yeah. It's like, get it as close as you can to the original. Mm-hmm. And obviously in jazz, it's a different scene, but like,
no, but they transcribe.
That's the same. It's the same idea though, right? Like you get, like Mark Turner, I remember Mark Turner used to, like, I remember when I first met him, he sounded like you literally could not tell the difference between him and Joe Henderson.
Right.
You couldn't. I mean, it was that purely perfect. Mm-hmm. And then I didn't see him for a couple months, and then I ran into him again, and he sounded like 1957 John Coltrane. Right. Like he was doing, like it was that. Right. And then it was like, then he went to another person, and then he went to another, and then eventually he like let it all go, and he became the amalgamation of like 10% of this and 5% of that and 4% of this, and it became Mark Turner, you know. So I guess in a sense that is really the same kind of approach, which I had not put together. So that's a cool little gift you just gave me.
I've heard Shep talk about that too. You know, Shep talks about and Bob Shepard, you know, he talks about, I just had to say it for the audience. I know, you know, Shep, but,
he was the last person I played with. Like the first week into the quarantine before they really locked it down. Like we went to, like, he doesn't live far from me and he's got, played in his crib.
North Hollywood, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So we'd go, he was the last, like, that was the last gig I like session I played, last live band I played with.
Well, that's a good one. But he talks about when he does master classes. Oh, geez.
Yeah, Roy Boss.
Roy Dunlap, man.
Yeah, Roy Dunlap.
Well, that's another conversation. I hope he's rocking it. I miss that guy. But
he's doing good out here, man. He's doing good.
But I mean, Bob talks about the fact that, you know, when he was learning Sonny Rollins, and Seamus Blake said the same thing in his masterclass. And, you know, he's like, you want to get the vibrato just like Sonny. He's like, when you're transcribing something, you know, you get like the vibrato exactly the same, like the way they bend into the notes, the way they breathe, like get breath into their note, like exactly, like, because it's all part of the learning process. And then, you know, it's just like good work to do, you know. I mean, also it's fun, you know, it should be, you know.
Yeah.
But
and you might need that sometime.
Oh, if, man, you definitely,
certain artists, man, they want exact stuff here, and
it's
there,
just good, like, to be able to have different tones on your instrument, you know. I know that you know, Charles is really influenced by Philly Joe, obviously, and, you know, and by, you know, Gad, and by all these different people, and you know, those aren't bad things to have in your pocket and or in your stew. Right.
Yeah, that's the way I think about it, is, and that's like what I tell, like, the younger people that I teach, or the people that are like sort of at the front end of their jazz thing. It's like you want to study all of them, and then like that thing about Mark Turner, right? If you do that and you learn like this element of Max Roach and this element of Tony Williams and this element, and it's like you learn the whole their whole sort of spectrum. And then at the end of it, it's like, well, again, I'm going to take 10% of this guy and 3% of that. It's like, you just, let's say that me and you and Jake, all three of us are drummers, and we're all mainly influenced by Philly Joe, Steve Gadd, Dave Weckl, Bernard Purdy, and Josh Fries, right? Those are our main five dudes, right? It's like, because we're three different people, like, I'm going to be 10% Josh Fries, but Jake is going to be 13% Josh Fries, and Adam's going to be 20% Josh Fries. And so it's the way that you, it's like any stew, right? It's like we can all use the same ingredients, but every stew is going to be different because how much of each, like, I like coriander more than you do, so I'm going to use more of it. And it's just that. And so on some level, I think each musician's first real foray into being creative is like choosing, in a sense, how much of each person they're going to cop and keep. Yeah. It's like, that's the first real sense of like, oh, I'm I like that little piece, so I'm going to steal that. And I like this little piece, and I'm going to steal that. And at the end of the day, like, you can't sound like, if you do that successfully, you can't really sound like anyone else, because your mix of, you know, like, I'm zero Billy Cobham, and you know what I mean? Like, I have none of that in my playing, really.
Right.
You know what I mean? But I have, you know, X amount of Herlin Riley, like that. There was a time where he was my main dude. So there's always going to be a flavor of him. You know what I mean?
And depending on what you play, it's more obvious. Like, if you're a bassist, an electric bassist, and like you even have like 20% Jaco, it's like super obvious, you know, because you know what I mean?
That's a good point. No, because
he's like, so identifiable, like what he did, you know what I mean?
Right.
It's just kind of the same with Coltrane, you know? I mean, it's like he's very...
It's the same with like Sko on guitar.
Or like if you had like 2% Alan Holdsworth, like you'd be like a Holdsworth clone because no one sounds like that dude, you know?
Why is he so far up the neck? What is he doing?
That's a great point. That's a great point that if you're... The more identifiable, unique sound someone has, the less of it that you can sort of cop without becoming a clone of that guy, you know?
Even if you're not, like, you just, people will be like, man, you sound a lot like Coltrane, you know?
This dude came up to me a couple of months ago. I was playing at the Lighthouse on this Sunday brunch, and there's this older cat, this older Asian dude who's just a really cool guy. And he came up to me and he goes, man, I hear a lot of like early Elvin Jones in your playing. And I was like not Elvin Jones, but like early Elvin
like
Jones. And I got really excited because I'm like, early Elvin is some of my main shit. There's like two or three records, like a Paul Chambers Quintet record with Elvin Jones, like, is some of my favorite Elvin Jones because it's kind of like before he became Elvin, really.
He's discovering his thing.
Yeah, he's kind of just a little, not subdued, but just a little more like almost kind of Billy Higgins-esque in that it's like, it's kind of... It's not really, there's not a lot of like peaks and valleys. It's kind of like on simmer where it's just like, it's one level, but there's all this popping and crackling and like oil, like just like kind of simmering, you know? And so there's nothing really jumping really way out. Like later Elvin, it's more like he becomes like really bombastic, explosive.
Yeah,
and like explosive at points, you know, where he's playing and then it's bam, you know?
Yeah,
whereas earlier Elvin is a little bit more like, but you know, it's just like, it's just popping, you know? And I really, I love that. Like, that has become a real thing for me. And when he said that, I was like, oh my God, like, it made me, you know what I mean? And I don't know if that's even what he was talking about, but I just got real. Yeah. I was just like, man, fuck yeah, dude. That's the best compliment I ever got.
He was just trying to be super hipster and he just nailed it.
Totally. Yeah. He blasted it. It was the best compliment I ever got, man. Yeah. Cause it just was, but that's the thing. It's like, there's the opposite end of like the Jaco thing, right? It's like it's sounding like some sort more obscure, even though Elvin's not obscure, like early Elvin kind of is a little obscure. You know what I mean?
Because he wasn't exactly like, if you sound like later Elvin, a lot of people do that impression.
Yeah, of course. That's kind of a standard thing. Yeah.
This is great. You know what I mean? And it's like McCoy, you know, it's the same thing.
Yes.
Like he's got a sound. Like, so if you do a lot of like Quintal voicings, like it's
right.
You got to do it your own way or you sound like McCoy.
Yeah, exactly. And then you got guys like Bill Stewart, right? Who is one of the very few few musicians of our generation who has a completely identifiable and individual sound.
Yeah, like, he's a monster.
It's harder to do the farther along we go. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
Because there's so much more information, you know? And Bill
Frizzell, cats like that.
Yeah, it's like it's harder. And you said Sko too, right? Like Schofield had like that's a sound. Like that is a fucking sound.
Yeah.
No one I mean that is his and his alone. Stern.
I mean, that's what set Matheny apart.
Pat Matheny too.
And he worked his ass off to try to find that kind of sound of just
like, or like Stan Getz, you know? You know what I mean? Like these guys just sound like, it's like if you're doing a Stan Getz impression, you know, or you sound like Stan, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, how the fuck do you do that?
That's a really incredible thing, right? To talk about Bill Stewart and Stan Getz in the same.
I know. Cause
like,
Bill's
that's
what?
A real, He's that's 50? A compliment to Bill. That's a huge compliment to Bill Stewart that like at 20 years old, wow, you already sounded like your own. No, you could tell Bill Stewart, like, you'll never fail a blindfold test guessing that.
I know.
You know, but now there's a lot of cats that impossible, are like into him now. You know what I mean? And now he's influenced so many cats.
I know.
You know, you hear certain things, you're like, oh, that motherfucker.
You're
going to
be at the
Bill
club
Stewart.
One day being like, you sound like an early Bill Stewart.
You sound like
blow some dude's fucking mind.
You sound like Bill Stewart when he was at the New School. Or
yeah, totally. I've done that shit, man. That happened not that long ago. I forget what the context was, whether it was a student or just whatever. I forget what. But some dude was playing and I was like, man, you're really into Bill Stewart, aren't you? And he was like, yeah, that's my dude. And I was like, yeah, it's like obvious. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Or Blade. So
we have to make a greeting card company where we just have the most fucking ridiculous jazz shit ever. Like,
I remember Joe Strasser used to say that like people would come up to him because I guess he was a roommate of Blade at one point or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know,
And, you know, these guys really into Blade, they'd be like, man, like, you know, what was it like living with Blade? And Joe would just be like, well, sometimes I would walk into the room and he'd just be levitating from the floor.
Totally.
And it was like, I couldn't figure out, but there was this glow around him. And then he would pick up sticks and magic sparks would fly, you know, just like some shit. He's like, he's a dude, you know?
Yeah, he's a dude. Although I will say
he's a monster. I love him.
Brian Blade. He was, we met like on a jazz festival, like in maybe what is it, 1992 or something. We were playing the Saratoga Jazz Festival. He was playing with the Jazz Futures, which was like Javon Jackson and Nicholas Payton and Chris Thomas and Peter Martin. I mean, it was a killing fucking band. I was in Ryan Kaiser's band at the time. With Potter and Meldow and Dwayne Bruno and we rode a bus from New York City up to Saratoga Springs, like everybody did, like a bunch of people did. And I sat and I didn't really know him. So we rode the bus up and I didn't say more than two words to him. But after I saw him play, I was like, I sat right next to him on the bus home. I was just like, so hello, you. And he just blew me away with his, everything about his playing blew
he's
me
a
away.
Monster, man.
And this was the thing that was really, actually a little bit fucked me up. He was the nicest person I had ever met in my life. Like he was like, and this is going to sound sort of dumb when I say it out loud, but this is just how it felt at the time. Like I already felt like he was the wisest spiritual person I ever knew.
Right.
Like there was a sort of not transcendence, but there was just this sort of like everything, like he was just like, everything is cool and everybody's cool. And I got nothing bad to say about nobody. And he just was like, I never met somebody who was so like, okay. Like he just seemed so like, it's all cool. And I was so like, what a nervous, like, what does everybody think of me? You know, like just constantly worried about me and my mind was inundated with like, what about me? Like was my thought process.
Well, when you're young, it's kind of, natural.
At 22, it was it's to be expected
trying
a little bit,
scene.
But
also when you see someone like that, over the top, just badass, you kind of want him to be a dick so you can just like put him
almost,
in a section of your life where it's like people have that problem, I think, with Chris Potter. Like,
he's the nicest guy.
They'll meet him and be like, he's so fucking cool and nice. I fucking hate him, god damn it.
Seeing Blade, I mean, talking to him for like whatever it was, the 2 hours back to New York, I was just like, how, I don't even understand how you are this person. Like forget the playing. Like you're just so okay. Like that's all I ever wanted was to be, to be like, he was just emanating that sense. So like when Strasser, obviously I know Joe a fucking 35 years, I've known him. Like I know, like, and I remember when Blade lived at Suite One, like I remember those times and And I know I've had those conversations with Joe. Like we laugh about that shit when people ask him or about same thing about Meldow or whatever, you know, just like, oh my God, what was it like playing with him? It's like, well, it was like playing with him, you know, you know,
he's great.
He's amazing. Like we all know that, you know, but we've talked about that. So I know where Joe is coming from with that. But in a sense, it's almost a little bit my experience that he was actually like levitated, you know, actually kind of levitated a little bit, you know.
He's like Sri, you know, Brian Blade.
Yeah, totally. Exactly. I was playing with Rocco DeLuca, who's this great slide lap steel player and guitar player, just a beautiful cat. And Daniel Lenoir too, like they worked together. And so we got, you know, we did a little work together and we did like a bunch of gigs on like a residency at this place. And then after the residency was over, they did one more gig with like Blade and his, and parts of his family and stuff.
Oh, wow.
And in fact, that night I went to that. And then right from there, I went to Catalina and saw Gad. I saw Blade and Gad on the same night. It was so heavy, man.
That's like drum overload, man.
Yeah, totally. Two of the greatest of just all time.
Great musicians, you know? Not just drums.
Just beautiful players, man. But, and I hadn't seen Brian in a long, long time, man. And it was like he was running out and I just kind of stopped him for a second. I was like, hey, man. And I think it didn't even register who I was. I was just like, hey, man, what's happening? I even said, it's Charles Ruggiero because I know that, like he knows so many people. How the fuck is he going to remember me? You know what I mean? We knew each other way back in the day, but you know, he's Brian Blade and I'm Charles Ruggiero. What I mean? Like what the fuck? So I reintroduced myself and I don't even think it registered. Cause he just was like, hey man. And I got a boogie and he left. But you see how many people want a piece of you when you're at that level, like when you're a star like that and you've influenced people in that way and you watching people want something from someone is a little bit gross. Yeah. And when I say a little bit, I mean really gross. And so I didn't obviously want to, you know, I did not want to contribute to that. So I didn't put myself in his way. I just kind of said hello as he was walking by but watching it happen as he was approaching me and then as he walked by, just like watching people,
right.
It's like the they get crazy.
Everyone
in their
wanted
eyes.
A piece of him,
you know? Oh, yeah. It's just such a, it's like, I hope I'm never famous. You know what I mean? I hope I'm rich and I hope I have some respect in the community, but I really hope that I never get famous because I don't think I could handle that element of it because it would force me inward, you know. Yeah,
well, I think we should end on that note because we've covered a lot, man, and this has been great. And we should end on I don't think I want to be famous because that's a good way to end. let's end on that note. But Charles, man, thanks so much for
doing this, man.
You know, we're going to bleep every swear word. No, we're not going to do that.
Actually, you should for sure do it.
No, we're just not doing that.
We'll be up all freaking night.
We're not beeping. No beeping. All right. So thanks so much, man.
I'll use like a rototom.
And exactly. All right. I can't escape. No.
Just octobons. Neil Peart octobon.
Yeah. But we could release a shampoo line, some Neil Peart Plus.
Yeah.
Along with our rototom.
All right. Enough.
Plug in.
But let us know when you're next. When you're ready for the next one, man. And
it's coming. I'm getting close, man. I'm getting close. It's a little. It's not complicated, but it's. I'm trying. I have basically the whole format. Mm-hmm. I feel like I mean I shouldn't be afraid of this because knowing me the way I talk, I'll fill the space. Mm-hmm. But it's like it's kind of like I have the format.
Right.
And I just want to be able to like be free with it. I got to like learn it kind of.
Right. You know, you don't want to read it. Yeah.
I don't want to read it. I want to like know it and just say it. And yeah. So
every time musicians say they're going to read something, they sound like they're reading, you know?
Yeah. I just don't want to do that. I like, you know, And a couple of, I'm kind of practicing because I got a couple of students that I'm working through these ideas with.
Oh, great.
And so I'm like,
yeah, beta testing.
I'm beta testing live with them.
That's cool.
So I'm not far. I'm not far away from wanting to actually go and shoot it.
Yeah, man. We'll see you next time, Charles. And thank you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you both so much. I'll talk to you later, guys.
All right. Bye now.
See ya.
Questions, comments, episode ideas, hate mail? You can get in touch with us by contact form, email, or voicemail, all of which are available at our website, theperformerspathway.com. If one of your questions or topics makes it into the podcast, with your consent, of course, you'll receive a shiny new $10 gift card for use at mymusicmasterclass.com. That's our sister website, which contains over 600 original educational videos from your musical heroes. So look forward to hearing from you.